if they're going to be good for anything, and maybe they won't be, but if they're going to do anything, what economists ought to be able to do is give some coherent explanation of what makes market prices the values that they are. All right, and so that is, I mean, it's not, that's not all economists do, but that's clearly the main task of an economist, at least as it would have been understood, let's say, in the late 1800s. Like nowadays, people might say the job of an economist is to tell a government how to cure poverty or something, but in terms of what is it that economists bring to the table in terms of the, and I apologize for the noise back there, my office building has a hair salon right next to it, so it's got its pros and cons. So the benefits, or what is it that the economist brings to the table? You know, a physicist talks about the constituents of matter and that sort of thing, the fundamental forces. Biologist talks about, studies life and explains evolution, that kind of stuff. What is it the economist does? Well, a main thing that they should be doing is explaining what moves market prices and why is it that a car is $10,000 and gold is however much, $1,400 an ounce, and why is it that a Bible is only a certain amount and a can of water or something else, right? So that's what economists should do. And we've already talked about why it is that economists, you know, their method's going to be different from those of the physicist or the chemist or the biologist. I'm not going to go over that again, but the point is, whatever their method's going to be, what is it that they're trying to do with it? And I'm saying what we're trying to do is understand how prices are influenced and what ultimately determines them. So it's not that we're going to be able to predict what the price of eggs is going to be 2 weeks from now, but the point is, economics should give us a framework, a way of viewing the world so that we can understand how various factors come together to make the price of eggs whatever it's going to be 2 weeks from now. That's the idea. Let me at the outset try to show you the kind of thing we don't want to do, okay? Because if you're not trained in economics, and I don't mean that you have to go get a PhD, I just mean if you don't know the basics that I'm going to show you in today's lecture, then you end up arguing in circles and you just spout nonsense, right? So for example, if you read a typical newspaper account of rising oil prices, a lot of times they'll say something like this. They'll say, and it's not that I saw this recently, but it wouldn't surprise me if you could find something like this. They'll say something like, well, because of unrest in the Middle East, the supply of oil is going to go down, and so the price will go up. But then because the price of oil goes up, motorists cut back on their purchases, the demand for oil goes down, and the price drops. Okay, so then you end up thinking that the price of oil is both going to go up and go down, and you don't know what's going to happen. All right, so that's the kind of circular argument that you will be able to avoid. All right, so what I'm going to give you tonight, and if you read the textbook, that's what we're doing here, is trying to give you a coherent framework so that you can think logically through and interpret and categorize and classify the different factors that are going to influence prices in the real world, so that at least if you're trying to tell a story explaining what just happened, the story is internally consistent and you're not contradicting yourself. Okay, that's kind of the idea. Okay, so demand. Let's start with that first because that's easier. So first of all, the definition. And here, more so than probably in any other topic in this course, I'm really going to be anal and stress the definition of demand and supply, and in particular, the distinction between demand and what we're going to call quantity demanded. Okay, so don't worry about that right now. We're going to get into it in a few minutes. But I just want to point out to you the reason I'm really harping on the definition here and typing it out, whereas in previous lectures, you may recall, I might just have, you know, A, B, and C, and I would just verbally say what it was, but not type it out. I'm typing these out because I really want to drive home the point to you guys that I want you to understand the definition of demand and supply so you don't end up using sloppy language. Okay, so it'll make more sense as we go through it, but I'm just stressing I'm being particularly strident on this point because you will avoid making silly mistakes in your reasoning about prices if you are conscious of the fact that these definitions are very crisp and they mean something specific. Okay, so demand, it's the relationship between various hypothetical prices for a good or a service and the total number of units that consumers want to buy at each hypothetical price. Okay, so demand is not a single number. It doesn't make sense to say, hey, what's the demand for oil right now? That's actually not correct. If what you mean is, oh, it's 87 million barrels a day, that's not the demand for oil. Because demand says, demand is the whole relationship. If someone says, what's the demand for oil today? What that really means is you have to say, oh, well, if oil were $1,000 a barrel, I think consumers would want to buy 10 million barrels a day. And if it were, you know, $950 a barrel, I think they'd want to buy $20 million a day or barrels a day. And then get down to, if it were $60 a barrel, I think they'd want to buy 120 million barrels a day and that kind of stuff. So see, demand is not just a single number. It is the whole relationship. So here we can look at, and this is, of course, taken from the textbook. This is Jennifer's demand for gasoline on a Tuesday afternoon. So I'm just, again, driving home this point. When you think of demand, don't think of a number. Think of a table like this that's got a bunch of different hypothetical prices and then what the quantity demanded would be at each hypothetical price. So this is charting or is illustrating Jennifer's demand for gasoline. Anyway, and I put in there on a Tuesday afternoon to remind you that this is a snapshot in time. So just to make sure you understand how to read this thing, on the left column there, we've got price in terms of dollars per gallon, and then the right-hand side, we've got the quantity in terms of gallons. All right, so it varies possible prices. You read across to the right, and you figure out how many gallons she would buy at that price. Now, in the book, I think I gave you a specific little story behind these numbers. So the idea is, if gas is $5, she's like, I'm not gonna put any gas in. That's too expensive. She just drives home. If it's $4, same thing. If it's $3.50, she might stop and get 1.5 gallons. If it's $3, she'll get more. If it's down to $1, she fills up her tank, which is 14.7 gallons, is what, you know, the empty amount room in her tank. And if it gets cheaper than that to 50 cents, well, again, she can just, all she does is fill up her tank. So that's why it caps out at 14.7. Okay, that's the idea. Now, I just talked to you about an individual's demand for gasoline. Typically, though, when we talk about the demand for something, we mean the market demand. So how do you get that? Well, you just list the individual demands of all the people in the relevant market. So for here, I listed not just Jennifer, but Beth and Jim and Dave and Hank and Jill. And you could just look and see that each one of their individual columns makes sense. All right, and you could tell a story. For example, Hank, I think, is someone who's on a road trip for work. And so that's why, and, you know, he's on a long road trip. So when he gets off the highway to buy gas, he doesn't care what the price is. He's going to fill it up because he needs to keep going, right, at least in this range. I mean, if the price were $50 a gallon because there was a nuclear attack or something, maybe he wouldn't fill up. But the point is, he has a 13-gallon tank. He's just about empty. He's getting off the highway. For any price in this range that I've listed, he's going to fill up his tank. Whereas these other people, they are much more sensitive to price, and so you can see how their behavior changes. All right, and I put in there Jill, the one at the end there, she, no matter what the price is, she doesn't buy any gasoline. All right, because for whatever reason, you know, Jill just doesn't own a car, I think was what I assumed in the textbook. All right, so I'm putting in different people to show you that their behavior is different. All right, so the one thing that's true of all these people is that as the price goes down, they buy either the same amount or they buy more. And so let me just make sure you see this point. It's possible for an individual person to buy more gallons at a higher price than somebody else. So, for example, if gasoline's $2 a gallon, Jennifer wants to buy 8 gallons. Right? Make sure you can follow that logic. Or you go down to the $2 and you go start moving right. You see Jennifer wants to buy 8. Now, Hank, on the other hand, if gasoline is much higher, like $6.50, moving over, well, he still wants to buy 13, which is bigger than 8. Okay, but so even though it's true, if the price of gas went up from $2 to $6.50, Hank would buy more gallons than Jennifer would. It's still true that for a given person, if you make gasoline more expensive, they either buy less or they buy the same amount, but they're never going to buy more as gasoline gets more expensive. Okay? Okay, so how do we then get the market demand? You just add up across the rows. So you say at $7 a gallon, the market quantity demanded is what? It's just the summation of the individual quantities demanded. And so you get 14.5, and then you just do that. So notice that if it's true for each individual that as the price goes down, they're going to buy either the same amount or more in terms of gallons, then that's going to also be true for the market, because the market is just adding up all those people for each hypothetical price. And let me just say that in other words. If it's true for each individual person that as the price goes down, the number of gallons that they buy either stays the same or gets bigger, then that's also got to be true for the market demand. Okay, hang on, let me just move ahead one slide here, a couple slides. Okay, I just wanted to see where I discussed this. All right, so this is now, okay, here we go. So here what I've done is I have graphed the market demand. So this is the actual chart of those numbers that we just derived on the previous page. So this chart obeys what is called the law of demand. Okay, so the law of demand says that other things equal, if the price of a product goes down, then the quantity demanded either stays the same or goes up. Okay? So, in these examples, I'm assuming that all the individual people obey the law of demand, and I'm assuming, therefore, that the market does. So you sort of get that automatically. If you assume the individual people do, it's got to be true for the market. All right, so let's just stop for a minute because I kind of went through that somewhat quickly, but let's make sure you followed that. Demand is not the same thing as the law of demand. Two different things. Okay, so demand, what's the definition of that? That is the relationship between the price, the various hypothetical prices of a product or a service, and then the quantities that either a consumer or a group of consumers want to buy at each hypothetical price. So that's what demand is. Now, the law of demand imposes a constraint on it, right? The law of demand says that if you're looking at demand, you're going to see a certain pattern. That pattern is that as the price goes down, the number of units that people want to buy either stays the same or gets bigger. Okay, so here, notice that, you know, what does the law of demand mean in terms of this graph? You're going to say it's downward sloping. All right, let me move on to a cleaner chart to make the point. So this, if you look at a typical economics textbook, you're probably not going to see this. Instead, you're going to see something like this. Either the thing on the right, which is a sort of smoother curve, or the thing on the left, which is a smooth curve, or the thing on the right, which is just a straight line. Okay, so let me just move back. This, again, was the actual plotting of those data points from the chart that we constructed, and you can see that it's not entirely pretty. And then economists typically in textbooks actually just draw demand curves like this, either with the curve on the left, or if they're really going to be lazy about it, they do it a straight line. All right, so why do they do that? It's because they're actually usually, for the purposes we're going to do it at this level, we're not dealing with real demand curves. Okay, we're just trying to isolate what things move prices, and we want to organize our thoughts. And so we'll see this later at the end of today's lecture when we start going through various scenarios and try to say what's going to happen to the price. And so that's really all we're doing at this point, at this level, in terms of principles of economics with basic supply and demand. All we're trying to do is give you guys a framework so that when I present you a scenario about such and such happens, what's going to happen to prices, and all I really mean is, are prices going to go up or down for these particular things that we're talking about? For that kind of thing, you don't need to know what the actual demand curves are. You don't have to go find the numbers and plot the chart. You just have to draw something to sort of keep the concept fresh in your mind. It's like a placeholder for your thoughts. Okay, so that's why, again, you're going to see something like this maybe in a typical textbook when they start out, just to get the idea across to you of where these curves come from or these lines come from. But then in practice, they're probably just going to start drawing these things. Okay, so I just want to make sure you understand there's no magic involved there. All it is that these are prettier to look at. And so if you're just drawing one of these off the top of your head, you're going to draw a nice smooth curve or even just a straight line rather than that jagged thing that I showed you before. All right, so as far as the law of demand goes, what it means is, actually, let me stop. Let me make sure I'm not losing anybody. If you should know how to read these things. I'm hoping everybody has graphed lines before, but these charts just mean, the thing on the left there is called the y-axis, and that's the price in this example, and then the thing on the bottom here is the x-axis, and that's what got the Q on it. All right, so that line just is showing you the relationship between the P's and the Q's. Okay, so going back here, just make sure you understand how I'm getting these little dots. To repeat, they're coming from this chart right here. For various possible prices, for it's $7, I know that there's 14.5. But that's what the quantity demanded is. So that means if I go to this thing now, it's $7. So I find the $7 there on the y-axis, and I move right until I hit that triangle, and then I drop down, and that would be, 14? Yeah, 14.5. Okay? So that's where those things are coming from. And so then here, this is just making a nice smooth thing. So it's like if you had enough individual points, it would fill in this nice little curve. That's the idea. It's like you're connecting the dots, and if it were nice and smooth, it would look like this. Okay. So last point here, then we'll move on. Again, demand, what is the demand? Demand is just saying it's the relationship, and it's not a single number, because a picture of the demand, or think of the demand schedule or the demand curve, it's this line, or the demand schedule is that table showing the various hypothetical prices. So demand is not just one single number. It's a whole relationship. Now, what is the law of demand? It's, in this graphical context, it's showing that these lines or these curves go downward. Okay, so that the law of demand, if we look at this right one here, the straight line, if the law of demand is true, then it means that this line is either going to go straight right and then drop down like a staircase, or it's going to be a sloping downward, but it's never going to jump back up as you go along to the right. That's what it means if the law of demand is true. Okay, so now that you got an idea of demand, let's talk about supply. Okay, so again, the definition, it's the relationship between various hypothetical prices for a good or a service and the total number of units that the producers want to sell at each hypothetical price. So again, it's supply is not a number, it's this entire relationship. And so here, we've got a supply schedule, and we can relate it to the law of supply. Okay, so here, just for to save time, I skipped one of the steps. I didn't just talk about an individual producer. I'm listing three of them right away. All right, so here's, walk you through this. Again, we're listing. So this thing right here is a supply schedule, and it's showing various hypothetical prices, how many units each of these producers wants to sell. And then if you want to get the market quantity supplied, you just add up across the rows. All right, so if we start at the lower amount, like at zero, nobody's selling anything, right? Because you go down to zero and you move across the right, the Quick Mart's got zero, Filler Up's got zero, and Farmer Jim's got zero. Now, as you start increasing the price, you notice that it either stays at zero or it starts moving up. So as we go from $1.50 to $2, up, all of a sudden, Filler Up now is willing to sell 10 gallons. So these numbers are obeying the law of supply, which, as you can guess, just says as the price goes up, other things equal, the quantity supplied either stays the same or goes up. All right, so that's what the law of supply is. So the law of supply for the numbers I picked here is going to be true for each individual seller, and that's why it's got to then be true for the market as a whole. So in terms of this story, let me just make sure you follow these numbers. I have the quantity supplied starts kicking in for Filler Up and then Quick Mart at prices that you and I are used to, right? So you start getting $1.50, $2, $2.53, and they start selling more and more. But then, but for all this range, Farmer John still sells zero, because in his mind, Farmer John's not in the business of selling gasoline. He's Farmer Jim. You know, he's a farmer. But the point is, if gasoline for some reason happened to get up to $6 or $6.50 or $7, that's such a high price for gas that Farmer Jim actually would sell some of his gasoline, right? Because he would think that's an anomaly. Gas isn't going to be that expensive 2 weeks from now. So I might as well, you know, because the idea is that Farmer Jim has a bunch of gasoline on his property because he, you know, runs lots of equipment and so on. And so he just happens to have a lot of gasoline. And so if the price got high enough, it would be worth his while to go set up a stand on the side of the road and sell some of his gasoline. All right, but he's not going to do it if gas is $3 a gallon, because what would be the point? He has to use gasoline. He would just have to buy it himself. But the point is, if gas for some reason got up to $6.50 a gallon, and Jim thinks it's probably going to be back to $3 a gallon 2 weeks from now, then he might sell some of his huge stockpile at the really high price, and then when prices come down, he'll go and replenish his reservoir. That's the idea behind these numbers. Okay, so, and that, you know, that might sound a little bit contrived to you, but in general, I'm just trying to get you to see why it is that the law of supply is true. Okay, and I think I didn't talk too much about why the law of demand is true, because I think that's more obvious. That as stuff gets cheaper, individuals want to buy more of it, or they're not going to buy less. They're going to tend to buy more. And then as it keeps getting cheaper and cheaper, some people come in and start buying their first unit who otherwise wouldn't have bought any. And so that's how you can see over the market as a whole, as it gets cheaper and cheaper, people buy more and more. The opposite's true with the supply side of the market. As stuff gets more and more expensive, individual producers who that's their line of business and that's what they do for a living is make that thing, they're going to tend to sell more and more units as its price goes up. But then at some point, even people who typically don't deal with this market at all are going to come in and start offering units to sell because the price is so high. Okay, and then as before, we can take the schedule, which is that table of the numbers, and we can graph it, creating a curve. And I'm putting that in quotation marks because depending on the actual numbers, it might not look like much of a curve at all. Okay, and so this is the graph of the particular numbers from that previous table. All right, and then again, if you actually use a regular textbook, and my textbook do, once we show you the logistics and where these things come from in practice, we're just going to be drawing smooth curves. Because again, it's not so much the actual numbers that matter. I just want you to get the basic ideas down, and then we're going to just deal with them sort of at a simplified level where the particular numbers aren't too important. Okay, so here, if the law of supply is true, what does that mean about these curves? It means they're upward sloping, right? That as the price goes up, as you move up on P, the Q is either going to stay the same or it's going to move to the right. And so that's why if you graph that, if it's a smooth line, it's going to be, you know, have a positive slope. And we describe that as upward sloping. Okay, so now that we understand the demand and the supply side of the market, what's equilibrium? Well, in terms of a graph, it's pretty simple. It's just where the two lines intersect. So you can do it with the real numbers I think I do it in the textbook. If you, you know, superimpose those two charts on each other, you'll see where they intersect. But again, in general, we're just going to draw nice straight lines. All right, so here, if I have my supply curve and my demand curve and draw them like that, they intersect at a certain point. And that point, what do? We do a dashed line out to the left and say that's P star. That's the equilibrium price. And that intersection point, we do a dashed line straight down and say that's Q star. That's the equilibrium quantity. All right, so P stands for price and Q stands for quantity. All right, so the next slide, we'll talk about why that is. Like, why do we call that the equilibrium? All right, so here on this chart, I'm just for brevity, I'm superimposing two things here, but let's talk about them in turn. What would happen if the price, for some reason, were higher than the equilibrium price, than the P star? So let's make sure you know how to read this thing. So we've got the supply curve and the demand curve on here. What if we had this PH? So the H stands for too high. The price is high. So make sure you know how to read this. I say, okay, at price PH, what would be the quantity supplied and the quantity demanded? And so you say, okay, how would you know that? At PH, you start there, and then you start moving right, and boom, you hit the demand curve first. And so at that point, technically, if you dropped all the way down, that quantity would be the quantity demanded at PH. And then you say, okay, what's the quantity supplied at this price PH? Same sort of thing. You start at the PH notch, and you start moving right, keep going past the demand curve, keep going. Finally, you hit the supply line. So you're much further to the right, and you know, technically you would drop down and read whatever number that was, and that would be the quantity at that price. So the gap there, that thing that's labeled as surplus with the brace, that gap is showing how much the quantity supplied is bigger than the quantity demanded at this price PH. All right, so make sure you understand where that's coming from. I'll say it one more time. The way you read these graphs, remember what the supply and demand curve are, is it's saying for various hypothetical prices, you pick the price you have in mind, and then you move right until you hit either the supply or the demand curve, and then you go straight down, and that's showing you what the quantity would be, either supplied or demanded, depending on which curve you hit, at that price. So what it means at this high price PH, the fact that if you start moving right, you hit the demand curve first, and then you got to move a lot more to the right to hit the supply curve, that means the quantity supplied at that price is that much bigger than the quantity demanded. All right, so now I'm just telling you how to read the charts, but now the question is, economically, what does that mean? So what if we have a surplus? We'll just think through what that means. So a surplus is saying at that price PH, producers are trying to sell more units than the buyers want to buy. So there's stuff just building up on the market. Producers thought they were going to be able to sell a certain number of units, and now they can't because the buyers just aren't don't want that many. So what's going to happen, the idea is, well, the producers are going to have to lower their price to try to get rid of this excess inventory. That's the idea. So what we're saying is if PH is, or if the price is too high, if it's above P star, then what I just said is going to be true. You're going to have a surplus by definition if the price is above what P star is, right? Because just looking at this chart, if you're above P star, you're in the region where the quantity demanded is going to be less than the quantity supplied. So the producers anywhere above P star at any price are going to be trying to sell more stuff than the consumers in that market want to buy. So that's why it's a surplus. Okay, going the other way, what if the price is below P star for some reason? So PL meaning P low, a low price. Well, this particular PL that I picked, you take that notch, you start moving right, boom, the first thing you hit is the supply curve. And so technically you would drop down and see whatever Q is at that level. And so that's the quantity supplied at the lower price. And you say, okay, at PL, what's the quantity demanded? So you start that notch PL, you start moving right, go through the S, keep going, you hit the demand. And you drop down, and so that distance on that axis of the Q axis is the quantity demanded at that lower price PL. So the gap between the two is saying how much more quantity is demanded subtracted from or subtracting away the quantity supplied, and that gap is the shortage. Okay, so you can see that that curly brace labeled shortage is the gap between demand and supply, quantity demanded and quantity supplied at PL. So what that means is at that low price PL, consumers are trying to buy that many more units than producers want to sell. So there's people who are in the marketplace, they see the price PL, they say, whoa, that's a great price, I want to buy a bunch, and they can't find it anywhere. It's sold out. That's what it means if there's a shortage, that people are trying to buy more than producers want to sell, and so somebody has to be unhappy. Buyers, right? Buyers can't get as much as they wanted to. Some people might get all they wanted, but there must be other people in the market who tried to buy units of this thing, and they're frustrated. They can't find someone who's willing to sell it to them. And so that's what a shortage means. So if that's the case, well, then what's going to happen? Presumably, the price is going to get bid up. That if you got a bunch of buyers walking around who can't get their hands on the product and they really want it, the sellers are going to be able to, you know, they're saying, well, why don't we raise prices? Because we're selling out, and people still want to buy more than we have, so why don't we raise prices? That's the idea. Okay, so what I've just talked you through, this general story, is saying if the price, for whatever reason, were higher than P star, there'd be natural forces, because there's a surplus, producers would tend to lower prices, so that would sort of push prices back down towards P star. If for some reason prices started out below P star in that region of the graph, you'd have a shortage. And so because of that, the buyers are frustrated. They can't find the product. You'd expect prices to start rising. And so you put those two things together, and what did I just show to you? Show you that if prices are above P star, they kind of get knocked down. If prices are below P star, they get pushed up. And then what happens if prices were exactly at P star? What, you know, on this chart, what is so special about P star? Well, it's the intersection. Why don't I move back here and show you that, right? P star, what's special about it is that's where those two lines intersect, which seems like it's a graphical point, but has nothing to do with economics. But in this chart, because we know what those curves mean, we say, oh, at P star, that is the price at which the quantity supplied exactly equals the quantity demanded. that's what it means that those things intersect there. That if the price happens to be P star, and you say, okay, how much do people want to buy, and you follow the, you know, the line up, and you hit the supply curve, and you go straight down, you say, oh, they want to buy Q star, or they want to supply Q star. And then I say, okay, how much people want to buy? Same thing, you start at P star, you move out, until you hit the demand curve, boom, you hit it, you go down, up, oh, it's the same thing. Okay, so the point is there's no surplus and there's no shortage at P star. The quantity that producers want to sell at that price is exactly equal to the quantity that buyers want to buy. And so that's why it's an equilibrium price. It's stable. There's no reason for the price to move one way or the other unless something changes. So in contrast, we're back on this slide. If you're at pH, that's not equilibrium. That's not stable. Because at pH, the quantity supplied is bigger than the quantity demanded. Producers are trying to sell more than people want to buy, so that's not stable. You'd expect the price is going to have downward pressure, and so on. Okay? I'll talk about the difference between moving demand and the quantity demanded when we deal with these scenarios. Okay, so we got about 20 minutes left, so that's good. We're fine on time here. We just walked through the definitions of demand, the demand schedule, which is the table of the different numbers, showed you what a demand curve was, and we talked about the law of demand. We did the same thing for supply, then we put them together, and we showed what the equilibrium was, and I gave you sort of quick argument as to why if the market weren't in equilibrium, it would get pushed back towards equilibrium. Okay, so now we're going to pick it up a notch. We're going to make it more complicated, and we're going to say, what if something now changes to move those curves around? How do we deal with that? All right, so before we dive into it, I just want to explain again the big picture of what we're doing here. I'm trying to give you a toolbox so you can just think through changes and try to understand the way those things would impact prices. So what supply and demand do, it's maybe I should move back a bit. Let me do that before we get into that last section. I just want to make sure. Where should I do it? I guess right here. Okay, so let's look at that supply curve, the one on the right side, right-hand side. So that's sort of a generic straight-line supply curve. So what is it that we're doing here when we draw that? Yes, the definition is saying list a bunch of hypothetical prices and then the relationship between those prices and the quantity supplied, that is the definition of the supply curve, if you graphed it. That's what that means. But in terms of the economics, what we're doing when we draw a supply curve is we're saying, look, there's all kinds of things that would impact how many units of a product you wanted to sell. So in this case, if we're talking about gasoline, there's all kinds of stuff that would influence how many gallons of gasoline the owner of the Quick Mart wants to sell on a Tuesday afternoon, right? If there's a tornado coming through, he's probably not going to sell any because he's going to be sitting in the basement shivering. He's going to turn off his pumps. If there's a nuclear attack, he might not sell any, or he might sell a bunch if people are lined up and willing to pay $100 a gallon because they need to get out of town. You know, if his daughter's sick, he might not go into work that day. If the government's going to put a big tax on gasoline starting next week, he might want to just get rid of everything at any price. Okay, so there's all kinds of things that could influence how many gallons of gasoline on Tuesday afternoon the owner of the Quick Mart wants to sell. What we're doing with the supply curve is we're saying, let's, you know, fix all those other things. So pick some outcome for all those things. So do you want there to be a tornado or not? And say, no, there's no tornado. Okay. But now you can't change that. We're assuming we're dealing with a scenario where there's no tornado. You don't get to change that now for the purposes of this analysis. And you say, is the guy's daughter sick? No, she's okay. All right, well, then now you can't change your mind on that. Do we think there's going to be a huge tax on gasoline imposed next week? No, we're not assuming that. Okay, well, then you got to be consistent. Don't change your mind on that issue. And so you run through and you just decide, what do I want to be assuming for all those possible things that could affect the owner's decision on how many gallons he wants to sell. And now, the one thing you are allowed to change is the price of gasoline. And that's what we're tracing out with this supply curve. All right, then we're saying, okay, keep everything else constant. Now, if I change the price of gas, how many gallons does this guy want to sell? And that's what we did with that supply schedule for the column of the Quick Mart guy. And you do the same sort of thing for everybody else. You add up those numbers and get the market supply. Okay, so it's not that we're predicting with this what the price will be or what the quantity will be. We're just graphing our understanding of how either the market or a particular person's behavior would change if you held everything else constant and just tweaked the price. So it's a similar thing with demand. Looking at that demand curve on the right-hand side there. In practice, you know, if you say about either a person or the market, how many gallons of gasoline do they want to buy on a Tuesday afternoon? There's all kinds of things that could affect that. If the person's car breaks down, they're not going to want to buy any gasoline because they can't use it that day. If the person's on a real long road trip, they're going to want to buy a lot of gasoline. Okay, that kind of stuff. If their debit card stops working that morning and they only have $2 on them, well, that's going to affect how much gas they can buy. Okay, all kinds of things that can affect it. If they recently sold their motorcycle and now they're driving an SUV, that's going to affect how many gallons of gasoline they buy that Tuesday afternoon. Okay, what we're doing with the demand curve is I'm saying fix all those other things. So what do you think? Does she drive an SUV? No, she drives an economy car. Okay, well, now you're fixed. You can't in midstream flip that assumption. Just if you're saying she's driving that car, that's what she's driving. Is she going on a road trip? No, she's just going home from work. Okay, well, then now you can't change your mind. So you figure out what you want to assume for all those other possible things. Make up your mind, okay, now hold them steady, and the one thing we are going to change is the price of gasoline, and then ask at each hypothetical change, what does Jennifer want to do if the price is $3? What if it's $2.75? What if it's $2.50? Okay, so that's what we're doing when we draw these curves, is we're holding everything else constant, and the one thing we are changing is the price. Okay, so we're separating the world into, you know, we're splitting up things that can affect how much you want to buy and how much you want to sell, and we're putting all the causes besides price in one box, and then we're having the price of the product in the other box, and that's what we're tracing out with these things. Okay, so now that I've harped on that, I hope you'll understand now the reason I did that is because now we're going to start changing those other things one at a time. We're going to say, okay, now we'll start out with an original situation. We'll draw the curves. Everything will be steady. And now I'm going to start changing those other things that before we had to hold constant. And we're going to see how does that move the actual curves. Okay, so for this first example, it's a supply reduction, which is the same thing as saying a leftward shift in the supply curve. So the specific scenario that I have in mind, I just realized I was falling off the screen there for you guys. The specific scenario I have in mind is the oil market and OPEC announces that they're going to reduce their daily output. And so the amount of crude oil brought to market is now going to be lower than it was a month ago before they made this announcement. So now the question is, what other things equal, what's going to happen to oil prices because of that announcement? Okay, so I'm going to spend more time on this one than the subsequent ones because I want to make sure you really get what's going on here. before we just jump into the answer. I want you to understand what we're doing. So remember, originally we were going to draw just a generic demand and supply curve, saying holding everything else equal, change just the price of oil, and we can trace out how much oil people want to buy and how much oil people want to sell. And so as long as the law of demand and the law of supply are true, you know you're going to have some demand curve that's downward sloping and a supply curve that's upward sloping. Now, it's true in the real world, it's not going to be a nice straight line. It's going to be jagged, and there's going to be points all over the place. But for our simple analysis at this level, we're just going to draw nice straight lines to keep it simple. Okay, so that's what we've done here with that S1 and the demand. And so you have your original equilibrium of Q1 and P1. Okay, so all that is drawing the original supply, original demand, and then looking at the intersections. So the Q1 is saying where did the original supply and demand intersect, and the P1, same thing. Okay, so that's what we've done up till this point. Now I'm going to change something. I'm going to say OPEC announces that they're going to restrict their output. So you have to ask yourself now, is that going to move any of these curves? And so that in these exercises, that's what you're ultimately trying to do. You're always going to be drawing an original supply and demand curve, and then you're going to interpret the words, like the change in the scenario that the words tell you, and your job is going to be to say, which of these curves, or it could be both, are going to be shifted because of this new information. So in this case, you have to say, well, if OPEC is reducing their output, that is primarily something that's going to affect the supply side of the market. That's going to shift the supply curve. And this is crucial, so let's make sure you get this point. Remember, what we're trying to think through here is what's going to happen to that relationship. So you're not trying to guess ahead and say, are consumers going to end up buying more or less oil? That's not the issue. Because remember, demand is not a number. Demand is that whole relationship. So demand is saying it varies hypothetical prices of crude oil. How many barrels would the various buyers want to purchase? And the buyers of crude oil are people like, you know, oil refiners and airlines and stuff like that. So just the fact that OPEC makes an announcement and says we're going to produce fewer barrels per day, does that directly affect how many barrels of oil a refinery wants to buy at various hypothetical prices? And, I mean, you could tell a complicated story where maybe it would matter, but in general, no. At face value, why would that matter? That the people who are buying crude oil to turn it into gasoline, they don't care how many barrels OPEC is producing. What they care about in terms of their margins and everything is how much do I have to pay for a barrel of oil? Right? So it's still the case that for various hypothetical prices, they're quantity demanded is going to be the same as it was before. Now, you look at the supply curve and you say, okay, what about supply? What is supply? The definition, various hypothetical prices for a barrel of crude oil, how many barrels do I as a producer of oil want to sell on the market? And we're going to say, is that going to be affected now because OPEC says we're going to restrict our output? Well, yeah, I mean, almost by definition. That's what it means to restrict your output, is you're saying we're going to now sell less oil. And so if they're going to follow through on that, you know at various hypothetical prices, they're selling less than they would have done before the announcement. Okay, so that's why in this picture, I'm drawing a new supply curve, that S2, that's to the left of S1. Okay, incidentally, the reason I wrote S1 is because I knew that was going to be the curve that would move. But strictly speaking, you could originally draw a demand and a supply without any little numbers and then ask yourself which one's going to move. And then once you convince yourself it was going to be the supply and you knew you had to draw a new supply curve at that point, you could write a 1 on the original one, and then a little two under the second one so that you keep them straight. Okay, but I sort of cheated because I knew what the way the answer was going to go. Okay, so you draw that new supply curve, and what you're doing, when you draw that new supply curve, all you're saying is, I have changed one of those other things. Now, I'm going to start from scratch and say, of all the oil producers at various hypothetical prices, how many barrels of crude oil do they want to bring to market? And I can go fill that table out and then plot it and make this new curve. And because they are producing fewer barrels per day, which is what they said they would do, then it has to be the case that if you go through that exercise and plot it out, the new curve is going to be to the left of the first supply curve. Right? Because it has to be the case that when you start at various P's and move over to the right, you're going to hit the supply curve, you know, earlier so that you end up, they end up selling fewer barrels. All right, so it's, for some of you, this is obvious and it would have clicked in 2 seconds, but for some of you, maybe algebra and graphing is not your strong point, so I just want to make sure you're understanding that we occasionally talk about moving the supply curve, and it looks like here with this arrow that I picked up the S1 and shifted it over to the left, but strictly speaking, it's not that you're physically moving the curve, it's that the things that went into drawing the first curve are no longer true. We changed one thing that was important. We changed the fact that now OPEC countries, for some reason, want to produce fewer barrels per day. And then with that new bit of information, we're going to draw the supply curve from scratch, and it just so happens that it's to the left of the original one. And so that's why, loosely speaking, we say, oh, the supply curve moved to the left. But really, it's that we're redrawing it, and it ends up being to the left of the first one. Okay, so now what happens here? So I hope I haven't lost you. You understand what's going on here. So now we want to say, okay, now that the change has gone into effect, we've got a new supply curve. We've argued that the demand by itself really shouldn't change. What's going to happen to the price and the quantity of crude oil in equilibrium? Well, now you want to say, where does the new S curve, the S2, where does that intersect with the same demand curve? And you can see it's sort of to the up and to the left of the original intersection point. And so if you draw the dotted line from that new intersection point off to the left, you get a new price, this P2. And if you draw a dotted line straight down, you get a new quantity, this Q2. So what that's showing is the new Oops. Okay. I think we're back. Sorry about the freeze up there. So if oil prices originally were $80 a barrel, maybe now they're $100 a barrel. And if originally there was the quantity produced and purchased was 100 million barrels, maybe now the quantity has dropped down to 75 million barrels. Okay. So here's the important thing. Let me remind you of the way a typical news story might talk, and then now you look at this chart, you can see the proper way to say it. So remember, the typical non-economically rigorous news article might say, OPEC today announced that it would restrict the supply of oil, causing prices to rise, but the higher prices would mean consumers would reduce their demand, pushing prices down. And so then you wonder, well, so what is it? Did prices go up or down? So looking at this chart now, you can see what really is going on. Because of the OPEC announcement, yes, the supply was reduced, the supply curve of oil, meaning the whole relationship at various hypothetical prices, how many barrels would be produced, that whole thing shifted. So that's why the curve itself moves to the left. Now, because of that, because the demand per se wouldn't shift, that means the new intersection point occurs at a higher price. So now, because the price is higher, the quantity demanded goes down. All right, so it is true that consumers are buying fewer barrels of oil now than they did before the change. But it's sloppy language to say because the price went up, demand went down. And so that's what I'm saying. I'm harping on this distinction. Here, what happened, supply went down, demand stayed the same, because demand is the whole relationship. It's this whole curve. What did change was the quantity demanded, because demand and quantity demanded are different things. So let me just say that one more time. Here, the entire supply curve itself moved. You could say supply was reduced. Demand was not reduced. Demand stayed the same, but because supply went down, that meant the new equilibrium price was higher, and because the price is higher now, the quantity demanded went down. So another way of expressing this is saying that the supply curve moved, but we merely moved along the demand curve. And so let me just, you know, just look at this chart again. What does that mean? To say the supply curve moved should be obvious, right? We took the original supply curve and shifted it left, so the whole curve moved, but the demand curve didn't move. All we did was we moved along it. We started at this lower right intersection, and then we moved up and to the left along the original demand curve until we stop at this new intersection. Okay, so I'll just say one more time. With this example, supply moved, supply shifted to the left. We had a drop in supply. These are all equivalent ways of expressing what happened. Demand stayed the same. Demand did not fall. But because the equilibrium price went up, we moved along the original demand curve because the quantity demanded went down. Okay, so now that I went through that one sort of laboriously, we'll go through these other examples a little bit more quickly. Okay, so next example is we have a demand reduction. And let me, I forget what the story was behind this. Let me just see. Okay, so here the story, this is actually the third example from the textbook. So the demand for apples goes down in this example because the price of oranges had gone down. All right, so it's getting a little bit trickier here. So let me just walk you through that. What I'm doing in this example is I'm just saying, let's talk about the market for apples. What would happen to the price and the quantity of apples in equilibrium if I tell you that the price of oranges drops by a lot? What do you think is going to happen to the market for apples? So that's the question. So the way you would do that is you say, okay, first let me draw a supply and demand curve for apples, and now I want to think through how would a drop in the price of oranges impact the supply and or the demand for apples. And then once you figure that out, you'll know your answer. All right, so let's think through the supply curve, because I'm cheating and looking ahead and knowing that's not going to move. So I'm somebody who grows apples and I sell them. Okay, we're going to say, is it, at least, you know, in the short run, right away, am I going to care that much about what the price of oranges is? And it, actually, now that I'm thinking through, you could come up with a story if you wanted to. Well, no, because the same farmer's probably not growing apples or oranges. So this is, I take that back. So in general, if the price of oranges goes down, that's probably not going to affect you as a supplier of apples. Because remember, your supply decision, you're saying at various hypothetical prices of apples, how many physical apples do I want to sell, or how many bushels or whatever. I don't know what the quantity is that they use in the industry. That's what you're asking. So now if I say, oh, guess what? Oranges just went down a dollar per pound in price. What do you think of that? As a supplier, I don't care directly. No, it is going to impact my business because it's going to affect the demand. But in terms of me selling various amounts of apples at hypothetical prices, the fact that you just told me oranges went down in price, that by itself doesn't directly impact me. So that's not going to affect the supply curve. What is going to happen, though, is we say the demand side. We say, okay, I'm a consumer, and I buy apples at the store, and I originally had a certain demand curve. At various hypothetical prices of apples, how many apples did I want to buy? And now I just realized that oranges are a lot cheaper than they were last week when I was in the store. What is that going to do, other things equal, to my demand for apples? Well, it'll probably reduce it, right? Because apples and oranges are substitutes, at least for some people, meaning within a certain range at least, some people, if the price of one of these things goes down, they're going to want to buy more of the other thing. So some people just go to the store looking to buy fruit. If there's a sale on oranges, they might buy oranges that week instead of buying any apples. Right, that's the idea. Or if you're making a fruit salad to bring to a picnic, and originally you were going to buy an equal amount of, you know, you're going to buy a bag of oranges and a bag of apples and cut them all up and put them in a thing, and you get to the store, and holy cow, oranges are ridiculously cheap today. Maybe you're going to go heavy on the oranges and go lighter on the apples. Okay, that kind of thing. Or if you're a restaurant and you put out, you know, fresh fruit or something, if all of a sudden oranges are ridiculously cheap for some reason, maybe you'll just switch and put out oranges only that week. And then you'll go back to having an even mixture once orange prices go back up. Okay, so you see just different reasons. For people who are in the market to buy apples, some of them might not care, but probably a lot of the people in the market will tend to buy fewer apples, even at the same apple price, if the price of oranges goes down. Okay, so that's, I know that's tricky. Let me just say that again. The thing that's changing here, the reason we're moving the demand curve itself, the reason we're not just moving along it, is because here, the hypothetical change that's going to set in motion a curve moving around is a different price. All right, so I'm not saying the price of apples changes, and so therefore one of these curves is going to move, because that's wrong. Remember, these curves are already accounting for price changes of apples. That's what the curves mean. But what I'm saying is, if the price of oranges goes down, then the demand curve itself for apples shifts to the left. Okay. Incidentally, if some of you are getting a little lost, it's probably just because it's a lot of information. So it's good these lectures are recorded. If you're getting a little bit lost, I think if you just, you know, hear this and then go reread the section and maybe draw some stuff and think about it and then listen to the lecture again, it'll make a lot more sense. So if you're getting a little bit overwhelmed, don't panic, but given our time, I got to just keep plowing through this. But just if you listen to this part of the lecture again, it's actually not that hard, but if it's new concepts for you, you might be getting lost. Okay, so let's just finish this example out. So the price of oranges goes down. I've given you an argument as to why that really shouldn't move the supply curve for apples, but it will reduce the demand for apples. And so now at the new equilibrium price, since demand shifted left, you draw the new dashed lines, and you see that P is lower, P2 is lower than P1, and Q2 is lower than Q1. Okay, so what that means is, and this is true in general, if you have a reduction in demand, the equilibrium price is going to go down and the equilibrium quantity is going to go down. Okay? And here again, what happened, the demand shifted left, the supply did not change. We moved along the supply curve. So the quantity supply changed, but the supply curve itself did not change. So here, the way you handle this is you say, okay, the price of oranges went down. That shifted the demand for apples to the left. That pushed down the equilibrium price of apples. And at the lower equilibrium price, we moved along the supply curve of apples so that the quantity supplied of apples went down. Okay, so that's the correct way to describe that. You wouldn't want to say, oh, the demand for apples went down, so the price went down, and so at the lower price, the supply for apples went down too. The supply did not change. The lower price you moved along the supply curve. Okay. Now this one, making it a little bit more tricky. This example, we're doing a demand increase, which is the same thing as a rightward shift in the demand curve, but I wanted to make it a little bit trickier, introduce one more complication, that we're showing this happening in a situation where I see someone in the questions is asking, why does the supply always stay constant? It doesn't. The first example we dealt with, the supply curve moved. Right, so the first example, supply curve shifted left. Okay, or do you mean, maybe you mean on this hypothetical example, sorry. That's probably what you meant. Okay, so in this hypothetical example here, this is a funky looking supply curve. And let me just explain why I did this, because I just want to show you how you would draw the supply curve in sort of quirky examples to be able to do the analysis. So here what's going on is we have in mind the market for apartment units, and the idea is that the actor from the vampire movies, I can't even think of the guy's name, shows you I'm not a big fan. Not that I care one way or the other, I don't even watch those movies. But the idea is that actor moves into an apartment building, all of a sudden there's going to be a certain portion of the people in the population who really want to live in that building now compared to the week before. So that means that the demand for those apartment units goes up, right? That people before, for various hypothetical prices, wanted to rent units in that apartment building, and now because that actor's in there, there's more, some people are now, you know, wanting to rent those apartment buildings that before wouldn't have wanted to, at least at certain price ranges. So the way that plays out is that the demand curve itself shifts to the right. And so that's what we see in this chart here. But the supply per se isn't going to move. Right? The owner of the apartment building, he doesn't really care, you know, whether or not that famous actor lives in the building, that doesn't affect the profitability of renting out the various units at different prices. So the owner of the apartment building the supply curve doesn't move. Now let's, again, be careful here. I'm not saying that the owner of the apartment building doesn't care whether a famous actor lives in it or not. Of course he does. In fact, you know, maybe he even lets the guy live there for free because he thinks, you know, it'll cause a publicity stir and all that kind of stuff. What I'm saying is, the supply curve, when you're graphing the supply curve, that doesn't move. This is probably an important point. Let me take a step back to make sure you're not getting lost here. So here, for example, this apple one, this is easier to think about. When I say that the producers of apples, the people selling apples, when I say the supply curve doesn't move when the price of oranges goes down, that's not the same thing as saying the sellers of apples don't care what the price of oranges is. No, of course they care. They know economics. They know that the price of their product is going to go down if there's a huge sale on oranges because they know the demand is going to drop. Okay, so they certainly care. If they read the newspaper and it says the weather was really great in Florida this year, there's going to be a lot more oranges on the market for the next 2 months, and you're an apple seller, you're going to say, oh, man, you know, I'm not going to be able to go on vacation this year now. There goes my trip to Disney World. Okay, but the mechanism is not that for a given apple price, now you're going to sell fewer apples. What happens is the price that you're going to be able to get is going to go down. And then because of that, you're going to sell fewer apples because now you're not earning as much per unit. All right, so that's the mechanism. So don't misunderstand. to say that a certain curve stays constant doesn't mean that those people don't care one way or the other about the news. It just means the news may affect them by moving along the curve in a way that they might not like or that they would like. Okay, so same thing here with this apartment unit example. Of course, the owner of the apartment is going to be thrilled when that actor applies to you know, start renting an apartment there. The owner is going to throw a party and buy a bunch of champagne. But it's not that the supply curve is going to move. It's just that he knows now the demand for his product is going to go up, and so that means the equilibrium price is going to be higher. Okay? So now, what's going on with this funky supply curve? It is, the reason I drew it like this is because I want to set the story I have in mind is that for very low prices, the owner of this building, so there's a person that owns a building, let's say it's, you know, like a 10-story building, and it's got 50 apartment units on it, right? On each level, there's 5 units, and it's 10 stories high, so there's 50 apartment units in this building. And I'm saying for a very low price, if the price is zero, you say, how many units would the owner want to rent out? And I'm saying he wouldn't rent any out. Why would he let strangers come into his building, give them keys, and have them and their family living in a unit, possibly setting it on fire, you know, if they fall asleep and they're smoking or something, or having a wild party and, you know, busting a window or something? Why would he go through that hassle if the price is zero? If those people are paying him $0 per month, he wouldn't do that. He would rather just keep the building empty, store his stuff there, have a place. If his, you know, if he's got relatives from out of town visiting, he can say, "Hey, I've got plenty of vacancies in my empty apartment building. You can live there, or you can stay there." All right. If it were zero, and they say, "Okay, well, what if the market price for apartment units in that neighborhood was $1 a month? How many would he rent out then?" And say, "Still, it's not worth his trouble to have tenants come and give him keys and have to deal with all that stuff if he's earning $1 a month." All right? And so that's true for a while. And so that's this part of the of this dark black line starting at the zero point and moving straight up, saying for very low prices, the quantity supplied is zero. So the physical apartment unit still exists, of course, but the point is it's not on the market. The owner of it is not offering it to rent out. So it's not part of the quantity supplied. Now at some point, you see, all of a sudden, boom, we go all the way to the right to this Q1. And then we start moving straight up there. So the idea here is I'm saying for this particular apartment building, at some point it all of a sudden becomes worthwhile that, you know, if the rental price was $495 a month, the owner says, "Nah, it's not really worth my while." But now it's $500 a month, and he says, "You know what? Now I want to start renting out apartments. Then it makes sense." And just to keep things, you know, it's sort of exaggerated, but the idea is, well, if he wants to rent one unit at $500, why wouldn't he just go ahead and rent them all? And that's the idea. And so I had a big jump there. And so the idea is once it's worth his while to start renting out apartment units, he goes ahead and tries to rent them all out. You know, once it makes sense and it's worth his while to take in a tenant, to give them keys, to answer their call in the middle of the night if they, you know, if the water heater breaks, that kind of stuff. Once it makes sense for him to do that for the first family, well, then it's not that much harder on his part to do it for more families, and he's just getting more and more money for every unit he rents out. So that's the idea, that once he gets over the hump and starts renting out one unit, he's going to go ahead and open up the floodgates and try to fill that building up with 50 different tenants. And so that's why there's this jump in the supply curve. Okay, so with this funky supply curve now, in this scenario, what happens if you had the original demand curve that intersected in the region where the building's fully rented out? Right, so there already are 50 people living in this building, or 50 families. So technically you did move along the supply curve, but since it was vertical in this region, the quantity didn't actually do anything. You just moved straight up. Okay, so what happened is the equilibrium price goes up, but the quantity supplied stays the same. So what's happening in terms of how is the market working here? It's still working. This is good. This isn't the market failing or the market ripping people off. What's going on here is because now that actor moved into the building, there are some people in the community who really want to live in that building now who didn't want to last week. And so now the price ticks up. So what ends up happening are the people who are really fans of that actor and just hope that they can see him in the laundry room or, you know, bump into him in the elevator, they now get to live in that apartment building, and they're willing to pay for it. So that's what that higher price is doing. It's rationing the scarce 49 other units in that apartment building to the people who really want to pay for it and live there. And so, yeah, there are some people who may move out of the building now. The people who originally were paying P1, and they don't care about that actor, and now the actor moves in down the hall and the price goes up to P2. And so maybe now the owner says, okay, when your current lease is out, I'm raising the price by $300 a month because that's what the market will bear now. And so those people say, well, then we're moving out. As soon as our lease is out with you, we got to leave because that's too expensive. You know, that seems unfair to them, but what's going on is it's catering to the desires of the people who weren't originally living in the building. And now they want to move in that building and pay the $800 a month or whatever it is to live in that building. So it's the market is still working here. It's just the price is like a signal saying, whoa, there's something in high demand here, and there's a very scarce thing. There's only 50 of these apartment units to go around, and so the price is rationing it into the hands of the people who are most willing to pay for it. So that's what's going on there. Okay, last example, if you want to get really tricky, you can say what happens in a scenario where there's some major event or change that affects both sides of the market simultaneously. So these earlier ones we did, like with OPEC making an announcement, we said, okay, that's going to primarily shift the supply, and we're going to keep the demand curve the same. If the price of oranges goes way down, we said that's going to primarily affect the demand for apples. The supply of apples really isn't going to move too much. If the actor moves into that building, we're going to say, whoa, that's going to increase the demand for those apartment units. It's not really going to change the supply too much. In this final example now for tonight's lecture, we're going to discuss a scenario in which the postulated change affects both the demand and the supply significantly, so that we can't really ignore one and just focus on the other one because that would give us the wrong answer. We have to deal with the fact that both supply and demand are going to move significantly enough that we really ought to, you know, show that graphically. Okay, so the story in mind for this one is, I think it said, there's some new FDA report saying that the leather that is used in expensive shoes is actually very hazardous to your health. And if you're exposed to it for too long, you might get, you know, it greatly increases the odds of you getting cancer. All right, so what is that going to do now to the market for fancy leather shoes? So how do you deal with that? We say, okay, first of all, draw your original supply and demand curve and have your original price and quantity. And now you have to ask, the fact that now people think the leather in these expensive shoes can give you cancer, is that going to affect the demand for them? I think the answer is obviously yes. People are not going to be willing to buy as many pairs of shoes at various hypothetical prices now that they know those shoes can give you cancer. I mean, they still look snazzy, so the quantity or the demand won't go to zero. There will still be some people who are willing to buy really nice-looking leather shoes for $5 a pair, but the point is the price will have to come down to induce consumers to want to buy a certain target level of pairs of shoes. And so what that means graphically is the demand shifts to the left. But wait a minute, we're not done. what about the supply side? People who are selling these shoes, would that affect their willingness to stay in the business? And yeah, the answer I think is it would. That there'd be a lot of sellers that would say, you know what, I'm going to get out of this altogether. I don't need to be handling this stuff day in and day out. And so they would, so over time, the supply curve itself would shift left also. Okay, so now the trouble is, we know for sure that the quantity demanded and supplied is going to end up lower in the new equilibrium, because both the supply and the demand curves shift left. But we're not sure what's going to happen to the price. The price could go either way, depending on which shift is bigger. Okay, so that's why I have two different illustrations here, just to show you the two possibilities. So on the left-hand side, I'm showing what happens if the supply curve shifts more than the demand curve. Well, then you see the P1 jumps up to P2. And Q1, you know, gets crushed and goes all the way down to Q2. All right, so that's showing you if supply and demand both shift left, you know for sure equilibrium quantity is going to go down, and it's possible that the equilibrium price goes up, namely if the supply falls more than the demand does. But look at the right-hand side. Here, I made the supply shift just a little bit, and I made the demand shift a lot. And so Q still goes way down, but the price goes down as well. In other words, P2 is lower than P1. So this is showing a different outcome where supply and demand both go down. Quantity has to go down, you know that for sure. But price could go one way or the other. In this particular right-hand side, price went down, because I'm showing that the demand dropped more than the supply did. Okay, so in general, going through the various things, you know, if, think of the OPEC example, if demand goes down and supply stays the same, then quantity supply goes down, quantity demand goes down, and price goes down. Wait, what did I say? Wait, sorry, I said that backwards, because I got mixed up as well. Sorry. OPEC demand, first example, if supply shifts left and demand stays the same, then why don't I put it up on the screen so you can follow along, and also I won't say the wrong thing. What I said was right, but I didn't describe the scenario. Okay, first thing, the OPEC example here, supply shifts left while the demand stays constant. You know what's going to happen. You know quantity goes down and price goes up. Has to be like that. What about if, I skipped this one in here, but if supply were to go up while demand stayed the same, then it would be, the price would go down while the quantity goes up. Okay. What about this one that we're looking at right now? What if supply stays the same while demand shifts left? You know for sure, quantity goes down and price goes down. Okay, what about this one where supply stays the same and demand goes up? You know for sure price goes up. Normally we would say quantity goes up because, but this funky example, it stays the same. But it's not going to go down. Okay? And then here, the reason this one's tricky is because you've got something that's affecting both supply and demand at the same time. And so here, it depends which effect is stronger. But we can still say one of the things is going to be true. So if I say supply and demand both go down, then you know quantity has to go down in the new equilibrium. You're not sure which way the price is going to go. Suppose it's the other way around. Suppose there's a new FDA report that comes out that says people who touch shoe leather typically live 5 years longer than people who don't. Well, now what's going to happen is the opposite. Supply and demand are both going to increase. And so we know for sure the quantity is going to increase, but we don't know what's going to happen to the price because it depends which effect is stronger. Okay. That's that. Why don't we stop here? I went over. At this point, I don't think it makes sense to try to pull up the questions. I'll, of course, go through and answer them, and typing them out. But we've got about 2 minutes left, so there's not time to do it. And also, because Danny Sanchez wants us to, so this is optional. If you got to do something, you know, go ahead and have fun. That you're not required to do this. But if you do have an extra minute, it will. I think he said it's only going to take 5 to 10 minutes. So if you go in, so what do they need to do, Danny? Just click on that URL and use the password intentionality. That's all I got to do. Okay. So for those of you who are tuned in right now and you have an extra 5 or 10 minutes to spare, we'd appreciate it because we want to simulate it with a bunch of people logged in to make sure the kinks are worked out.